Greetings, welcome to The Dividing Line. It's not the day we're supposed to be doing The Dividing Line, but long story short, we just decided we needed to move it to today. Actually, we were supposed to be picking up our travel rig today, and I won't go into details, but hopefully tomorrow. I don't want to go there. But the point is that much is going on in regards to the Southern Baptist Convention. Yesterday's presidential election, yesterday's resolutions, the resolutions committee, the head of that committee, and the comments that were made. And then today, the resurrection of the resolution calling for the abolition of human abortion, and the amazing specter of the ERLC, Denny Burke, and what you might call the deep Southern Baptist state, standing against this resolution. And this leads us directly to the issue of the reality that a lot of us are not aware of, that I wasn't aware of for a long time, and that is that there is now a pro-life industry that refuses to call abortion what it actually is, and hence is more than happy with a restriction here, a restriction there, a restriction here, a restriction there. Meanwhile, the Holocaust continues of black babies and Hispanic babies and white babies and every other color of baby. While the idea is, well, if we can restrict it here, restrict it there, rather than just simply calling for its abolition in toto. And especially when that involves identifying it for what it is, murder, and the people engaged in it as being engaged in murder. That's where the pro-life industry simply says, no, we will not go there. Women are just victims. And, of course, we know that many of these women are nowhere near victims. They are rejoicing in what they do. But be it as it may, the resolution had not even been brought to the floor. And then I believe it was Brother Askell who, not Tom Askell, his brother, brother, anyway, gave an impassioned plea, and it was resurrected by 2/3 of the folks in the auditorium. And so it was debated today. Last night, the pro-life industry came alive, seeking to argue against it. Like I said, Denny Burke put a whole series up. The ERLC argued against this from the floor. This is another fracture point, fault line, shall we say, that is becoming clearer and clearer as time goes by. And my understanding is, while the resolution passed, it was, in the words of Jeff Durbin, gutted by an amendment. Others say weakened, but so our hope now is to have Tom Buck join us initially via Zoom, and we'll get his take on the elections, on the Southern Baptist deep state, and everything else. And then hopefully we'll be able to get hold of my fellow elder, Jeff Durbin, who is also at the SBC. And in case anyone's wondering, no, Apologia is not an SBC church by any stretch of the imagination. But he was doing some speaking, and he was working with the Southern Baptists who are seeking to end abortion now. And of course, Apologia is the home church of End Abortion Now. So that's where that connection came from. And so I'm sure there's going to be a lot of stuff to talk about along those lines. Have you heard it? Haven't heard anything yet? So I'm just waiting for Rich to give me a sign that Tom has been able to get to a location where he can actually have a good enough signal and hopefully sufficiently low ambient noise to allow a meaningful conversation to take place. If I recall correctly, a couple years ago when we had him on, he ended up outside. I hope he doesn't have to end up. I don't know what the temperature is in Nashville. I can guarantee you he would not want to be outside here in Phoenix, Arizona right now. It's actually not it's cooling off. Oh, 113. Okay, all right. There you it's only 113 degrees in the shade in Phoenix right now. So there you go. It's actually, the amazing thing is, I think one of the reasons it's been, when you were walking in, did you notice that it was orange? If you look at the sunlight, there's a major fire over near a town called Globe, up sort of northeast of the valley, and the winds are carrying all the smoke right into us. And so I think that's one of the reasons we haven't set a bunch of new high records here in Phoenix. So I am sort of watching a few other things at the same time. So if I look like I'm not paying attention, it's because I'm actually distracted by the fact that Jeff is texting right now, and I'll see what he has to say. And then we're just watching for the opportunity to talk to Tom Buck. Obviously, the election, the major thing that was on everybody's mind was who is going to be elected as the president of the Southern Baptist Convention. But before that vote took place, and it was a very close vote, many of us outside of the convention who have close friends and people in ministry that we work with all the time in the convention could not help but see what was going on. I have said for a while that the canceling of the convention last summer and simply giving a third year to J.D. Greer was probably suicidal on the part of the convention, in the sense that the president has a great deal of influence over who is placed on various committees. And what I saw, anyways, and we can confirm this when we get a chance to talk to Tom, what it seemed to me, anyways, was that the committee that was in charge, the resolutions committee, was in charge of bringing these resolutions to the floor, which I understand is a challenging thing, but was pretty much made up politically by the people assigned by J.D. Greer. And as a result, especially any type of pushback on Resolution 9 from 2 years ago, which opened the door to the acceptance of utilization of critical race theory, that whole pushback was, in essence, flushed. And so you saw that taking place. So Rich says that he has someone on Zoom who is a troublemaker from Texas. And so I'm going to put my earpiece in here and see if Rich can make things work. Hello, troublemaker from Texas. Hey, you're wearing a jacket?
I am. Can you hear me? That we don't know. We weren't able to do a test.
Yes, you sound fine.
Okay.
I mean, of course, you're demonstrating the standard error of placing a light source behind your head, you know, which makes you look evil and things like that.
Well, I can close this. That'll make it better.
Just
you want me to do that?
I'm just it'd probably be wise because when you do that, it does sort of, you know, it's sort of the Darth Vader type thing.
Well, now I'm in the darkness.
Yes,
so
it doesn't matter. Anyways, well, thank you, Tom, for taking some time out. I imagine it's been pretty wild there over the past 36 hours or so. I've been sort of watching from the outside, and I was just giving some of my thoughts, but you're there on the floor. What have you seen taking place at the Southern Baptist Convention? What are your overall thoughts as it stands right now?
Well, It's been an interesting week, to say the least. And someone asked me at the beginning of the week what would be the worst case scenario. And what I'm said would be the worst case scenario has ended up being the case.
Okay.
So for me, that would be that the messengers were not given an opportunity to address Resolution 9, which would include that our resolution, which we had over 1,300 co-submitters, which I don't know if that's ever happened before,
right,
of the resolution that we had on the incompatibility of critical race theory and intersectionality with the Baptist faith and message, which I helped author that and write that and was a submitter. So they just squashed that, didn't bring that out. So those two kind of things go together. And then if Ed Litton was elected as president, that would be the worst case scenario for me. And all of those things took place.
Right, right. Now, so I've seen some of the conversations and some of the video clips and stuff like that. What was the excuse that was given, the reasoning that was given for not allowing that resolution in regards to CRT? I saw someone saying that it was dealt with in another resolution, basically.
No, it wasn't. I mean, if it was, they didn't even mention the letters CRT.
Right.
The only time it was mentioned is when the president of the head of the resolutions committee, the chairman of the resolutions committee, made a cringeworthy statement saying, you know, he gave a lecture when we tried to bring Resolution 9 up, gave a lecture that he wished that some of us were as passionate about the gospel as we were critical race theory. And then said he didn't find critical race CRT anywhere in the Bible, but yet he said he did. Christ reigns or returns triumphantly.
Oh.
And I responded by saying that, remember when Paul said that I wish people were more passionate about the gospel than they were being against the Judaizers.
Right.
I mean, it's just an absurd false dichotomy.
Right.
But that's what they do. And then when they were asked about the resolution, they said, as you typically get, Baptists turn charismatic, and they talk about how they were led of the Holy Spirit, and they prayed as if no one who submitted this resolution, the 1,300 people, didn't pray, not led of the Holy Spirit. I get so tired of that kind of language that sets the people up to go, yeah, we should trust them because they have prayed and led of the Holy Spirit. So anyway,
right.
So they gave no more excuse than or no more reasoning than that.
So obviously, everybody at the top, everybody at the ERLC, everybody in J.D. Greer's office, they were well aware of the fact that there was a pushback on Resolution 9 from 2019 and that there was a large movement of people that wanted this addressed. But is it fair to call this the Southern Baptist deep state now, in the sense that, especially given J.D. Greer was given 3 years to solidify this this deep state situation?
Well, I mean, here's the thing, and you can determine after I tell you what happened, you can determine where you classify that as deep state. We were very open about what was going to be done. Tom Askell was very open that he was going to give make a motion to rescind Resolution 9. They were totally prepared for that. In fact, at one point when Tom made his statement regarding that, J.D. said, well, give me a moment to confer, turned around and came back and read from a statement. They had a statement that was prepared. It was clear that James Merritt had his statement prepared. I don't know how long he worked on that acronym. He might have needed to take a few more days on that one. But they were prepared to say what they were going to say. So, you know, I mean, that's the power or the advantage of being in control and the power of the stage, because they get the first and the last word, and they get to take as long as they want to filibuster or whatever. So, they were prepared. They had all their ducks in a row, and the people on the floor were prepared that were against these things. They called for the question at times very quickly. on a couple of different things so that they could end the discussion, even though they knew that we wanted to discuss more. And that had directly to do with Resolution 2, which is what they replaced our resolution with. That came out that inherently is not bad, but it did not say enough, and it did not address CRT.
So that obviously took planning and forethought and everything else. I heard that stuff going on in the morning, but I didn't know what that was going to mean as far as the afternoon election. And so when the voting took place for president, mm-hmm. What was it like in the hall? Did you have a feeling at that time what direction things were going? Because there ended up having to be a runoff. And so was there, what were people saying, especially when it was determined that there had to be a runoff, and in fact that it was between Stone and Litton, and that and Mueller had only gotten a relatively small percentage of the votes?
Yeah, very early on, I sensed that Dr. Mueller was in trouble. You know, he's a friend of both you and me in the sense of we a brother we love and respect. But it was clear that he was in trouble. And what I mean trouble, that he was not going to get a lot of support. I based that upon the fact that when the nominations occurred, how people responded after that. I was shocked somewhat by that because by the support of Mike Stone. And so two or three weeks, you've had a smear campaign like none other that I have ever seen against Mike Stone. Even the night before, there was a weird situation that occurred where and I'm not saying that that was set up. I don't know. And I certainly want to be careful speaking to this woman. I would say young lady. I don't know, you know.
That's
what
okay.
Her age was.
Summer and I actually talked about on the dividing line yesterday by name, so don't worry about it. We did discuss it. So, yeah, and she needs to be a person who is protected, not someone who's being abused by being used in the way that she was used in that situation. But it was very clearly aimed solely at him in a public context, and there had been other things. I don't know if you heard Doug Wilson's blog and Mayblog where he talked about Baptist baseball, but he did a great job in analyzing the allegedly leaked letters that came out from Moore after he had resigned from the ERLC. And so, yeah, I mean, this is like watching all the drama that takes place before the major political conventions and things like that. It was the same playbook, except it was being done in the Southern Baptist Convention. So there was all that stuff going on. But once it came down to, once you saw the numbers of the initial vote, did you run some statistics, some algebra, and go, Stone's got a good shot? Because I did, because I'm just sort of naively thinking that the Mueller votes are going to split and they're going to break for Stone. And it was really close. I mean, what was it, 60, a 60 vote difference, something like that?
Okay, at what point?
At the end.
The first vote or this?
At the end.
It was more than that, but it was less than 600. It was 500 and some.
Okay.
But that's still, I think, a minuscule amount of votes when you consider 3 weeks almost of ongoing attacks and smear of Mike Stone. And he won, if you will. He received the most votes in the first round.
Right.
By about the same margin, about 600. And then he ended up losing. So, here's what we can say without any doubt. The supporters of Albert Mueller elected Ed Litton.
Yeah.
That there's no doubt of that. I'm not saying Al Mueller did, but his supporters, the people that supported him, ended up swinging the vote for Litton. I spoke to some that did. And of course, Randy Adams was more in Mike Stone's, his supporters were more in Mike Stone's camp. They certainly didn't vote for Litton. Because Litton is way over here.
Right.
Litton is going to be a disaster. He's theologically sloppy, to say the least, in what has already came out with what I have today. on Twitter, which amazingly, I must live for rent-free in these guys' heads, because I tweet and it gets changed in a matter of minutes almost.
Right.
But he has already been interviewed, Ed Litton has, by the Houston Chronicle. And I don't know if you've seen this or not, but they asked him on the ordination of women. And here was his answer. He said, "The Baptist faith and message does not address ordination. It needs to be approached first step by the associations, but we're going to try to keep it within the boundaries as much as we can." then he said, he does not think, now, he doesn't think the Baptist faith and message addresses ordination. Then he says the BFM doesn't need to be tweaked because there needs to be room in the debate, and I'm quoting, "for less narrow conceptions of complementarianism." So it's very clear. Ordination of women is not addressed in the Baptist faith and message. Let's leave it to the associations, but let's dare not tweak the Baptist faith and message because we need to leave room for women ordination. How else can you read that? So this is what we all said was going to happen. He's not conservative whatsoever. And I was interviewed by the New York Times, and they said, "We're ultra-conservatives." Right. I said, "I'm not an ultra-conservative. If I'm an ultra-conservative, everybody in the Baptist, conservative Baptists in the past 25 years are ultra-conservatives. I am standing where we have stood for 25 years. These guys are progressives at best, and they're leading us away from where we were at the conservative resurgence, because we left the liberals behind when they were ordaining women. Now we're moving in that direction. We're not ultra conservative. They're progressive and moderates." And that's what I believe is the case.
So if history repeats itself, and I said this on Twitter earlier, if history repeats itself, what you're going to see is the pressure will start building up for modification, and it starts the way that you just described it. Well, we're going to leave it to the associations, da-da-da. But eventually, the pressure builds up to get the Baptist faith and message in line with where history is going. Obviously, the terminology will be opening up opportunities of ministry for women and getting on the right side of history and all the rest of that kind of stuff. Historically, that's how it has happened in every other denomination over the past 150 years that we have watched march down this road. And obviously, at some point along the line, a split takes place. And somebody says, "No, we can't go there." The one group that has tried to hold itself together despite all that are the Anglicans. And I just don't know how much farther that can even go. I mean, they've got female bishops and people blessing same-sex marriages in the whole nine yards, and it's just a part of the DNA of Anglicans to try to find the middle road. The problem is that middle road keeps going left, 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 left. That's not a part of the DNA of Baptists at all. And so we have this taking place. What's the trigger point where, I mean, already I know there are some churches just like, okay, that's it. We're on our way someplace else. But is there a trigger point that says, okay, that's it? We all need to get together and do something different?
Well, that's the discussion that's taking place right now. And I'm trying to be as careful as I can be because I've got to get back and talk with my elders. We've got to talk with our own congregation.
Right.
I don't want to signal, you know, from afar what we're going to be doing.
Right.
But here's what I can say without any hesitation. We can't keep doing what we've been doing.
Right.
For one thing, this is a distraction for me from my own congregation and from my family. This is not what I desire to do. I'm the pastor. I want to pastor a church. And as I told, I haven't been in politics in the past. I told the New York Times this morning that we elected conservatives to do the job of watching and protecting our institutions so that we could do our job. They need to be doing their job so I can do my job.
Right.
But conservatism has failed in the SBC. Conservatives, I should say, have failed us in the SBC. And the proof of that is Ed Litton was able to be elected. They have failed us tremendously. Danny Akin tweets out support of Ed Litton, and he didn't even have a clue that Ed, and by the way, when he supported him, said, he's the guy for me. I said, not from my standpoint, which when you consider that they teach standpoint hermeneutics
right
there, it tells you all the problems in the world with that seminary. But he didn't even take the time to check and see that this that Ed Litton doesn't even have a good, strong, solid statement of what about the Trinity on his own website. But yet we're supposed to trust. I mean, that's what you would think the president of a seminary in the Southern Baptist Convention would have the instinct to do before they would go and say he's the man for the hour, a man who says that the Father, Son, and the Spirit are co-equal parts of the one God.
Right.
We're in deep trouble in the SBC. And if we take what happened with the lack of support for Dr. Moeller, you do have to wonder if the mantle's been passed to Danny Akin. And if the mantle's been passed to Danny Akin, we're in big trouble.
Yeah, yeah, definitely, definitely. Well, you know, I was going to ask you about the abortion stuff, but we've actually got Jeff Durbin will be hopping on with us, and he was working with Brother Askell on that stuff, and I don't know if you ran into him at all there.
No, I've been trying to meet him, and I've been unable to meet him. Nobody will connect me with Jeff Durbin. And he may have told them, don't let Tom Buck get within 5 inches of him.
Well, I will definitely communicate your desire to get to meet him when we talk just now or in our elders' little chat thing that we have, whatever. We'll make sure to get you together.
Let me say one thing about that. I said this earlier, I wish that the leaders of the SBC would be as concerned about a resolution to abolish abortion as they are about protecting Resolution 9.
Right. Yep, and to have the ERLC speaking against it from the floor and everything else,
yep.
Amazing thing. But we'll talk with Jeff about that. Well, so it wraps up today. Is that how it works?
Lord willing.
And then you're gonna be heading home, and then after that, we still gotta talk about whether you're still brave enough to actually have me come by Lindale with my if I ever get my fifth wheel set up and the Alpha and Omega Roadshow stopping by Lindale. But you did tell me that in Lindale now you have Chick-fil-A, right?
We do have Chick-fil-A now, so I mean, you can come and stay and have every pleasure that you need in life right there.
Well, I hope that
I can also get you to Canes. We have a close Canes too. So
well,
see.
That's it. See, so is this not recording then? Okay, so Rich tells me that as soon as Tom left us, Wirecast crashed, and so I don't know if that means that it just went blank or just what, but he's telling me we're back on. I don't know. I'm going to assume that we are, or at least that we're recording and we'll be able to upload this or something. I don't know. So if I sort of stopped in the middle of a sentence or something like that, that's what live webcasting is all about. That's just sort of how it works. So we're trying to get hold of Jeff Durbin, and I sent the link to Jeff to see if he can join us so that we can sort of get to the other aspect of the story, and that is the fact that there were Southern Baptists for the abolition of human abortion who presented a resolution that was not initially brought to the floor. And then a impassioned plea was made, and two-thirds of the delegates, messengers, I'm sorry, is the term, the proper term to be used. Tom just texted, I killed the DL. Yes, well, I'm not sure you really have that power, but something did. I don't know what. Actually, I'll take that back. My phone told me yesterday to expect Wow, what is this? You are live on YouTube. Yeah, but I've never gotten a message on my phone before that said you are live on YouTube. That's weird. It's a little freaky, a little scary. But I have an app on my phone that warned me of possible telecommunication disruptions today due to a solar storm. So Tom caused a solar storm. Well, okay. Tom gets blamed for pretty much everything, so we can go ahead and throw that one out if you want to. Join on in. We'll see if we can get hold of Jeff. But as I said, two-thirds of the messengers had to vote to instruct the committee to bring the resolution to the floor, which they did. And so it was brought up today. And so while Rich and I were sitting around wasting half of our day today, I was watching and watching and watching to see what was going to take place. And so with that, let's find out what did take place. Aha! A face I have seen up close and personal more than once. I can't hear him though, Rich. Can you hear me, Jeff? It looks like you're muted.
All right, how's that?
Ah, that's okay. I'll never hear out of that ear again. But yes, good. Okay, so
I had it on unmute. It just did it by itself.
Oh, okay. It's Chinese. What do you want?
Yeah.
It does whatever it wants. It's going to mute you all the time because it doesn't want to hear what you have to say.
They're listening to every word right now.
Oh, they are, and we hope that they are convicted as a result. That's our desire. Okay, so we had Tom on. He sort of went through what happened yesterday and the politics and the resolutions and everything else, and then I've told what I know, and that is that the resolution. Who was the primary sponsor the primary writer of the resolution that was voted on today?
Well, to my knowledge, there's a number of people who were on it. There's a lot of people who are behind it, a lot of pastors supportive of it, but Bill Askell, Dusty Devers are two of the primary guys behind this.
Okay, and so it was Bill that made the appeal to the gathered messengers and had somebody holding a baby next to him.
I believe so, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that resulted in a two-thirds vote from the messengers to instruct the committee to bring the resolution forward today.
That's right.
Okay. All right. So that's Bill Askell, who is Tom Askell's brother, right?
That's right.
Okay. So Founders is everywhere. I mean, they're very, very busy and doing their thing. And in essence, what was different about this resolution than the vanilla pro-life stand that has been taken by the SBC in the past?
So this resolution was actually really well written. It provided biblical definitions, it provided clarity, it tried to address inconsistencies. This resolution was essentially a truly consistent Christian worldview applied to the area of abortion. And that's the best way I can describe it. Providing proper definitions, defining the role of the gospel in this, defining sort of the role of the church in this. And so I think it was a really well-written resolution, and it should have passed. I think with anybody who's a believer that believes in the authority of Scripture, who understands that the gospel is the answer to this, they should easily vote yes on this. I think the problem is that we have, as Christians, been so indoctrinated by our culture and, unfortunately, by the pro-life industry, not the pro-life movement, that's the people who are principally pro-life, but the pro-life industry that is sort of worked on the Christian mindset in terms of how do you address the issue of abortion. And I think it's important for people to understand when we talk about this, the pro-life industry has a doctrinal statement undergirding it. And I use that term doctrinal statement because we know what that means. They have a specific worldview. They have a particular set of beliefs about what's wrong. Is abortion murder? Is the woman guilty? What's the solution? How do you end this? Long-term goals, short-term goals, all that. And so what I think is important to recognize is that one of the major hitches in this for people is we have allowed for 50 years the pro-life industry, who professes to be neutral in this fight, not committed to Christ, not committed to the lordship of Christ, the biblical worldview, the gospel. We've allowed them to lead this, and so many of us have just assumed that's our team. These are the ones who are trying to end abortion, and we don't understand that the incremental approach that they have been doing for so long, and even the long-term approach about ending abortion, is in opposition to much of what we believe as Christians on this issue of abortion. I'll tell you what I mean by that. When we talk to the standard pro-life industry leader, they'll tell you, A, we are not explicitly Christian in our commitments. We're not doing this as Christians. We're not standing on the Word of God. This isn't a gospel issue for us. And when you talk to them, they will very, very proudly say, this is not a secret among them, this is what their position is consistently across the board. They believe that mothers who kill their children via abortion are themselves victims. And so in all of their opposition this past year to the bills for equal protection for all human beings starting from conception, in all their opposition, they have said consistently and every single time, we are not trying to end abortion with any penalties for the mother or the parents who were involved in this, because they say that they believe that mother and baby are both equally victims. Now, what that does from a Christian standpoint, a gospel-centered standpoint, is it robs women who are post-abortive, and it robs women who are going to have abortions of the gospel message itself. Because what they're saying to women is that you're not guilty for killing your child. You don't need Christ in that. I call this the fatal flaw of the pro-life industry. And so that's underneath all of this. When we talk about the approach to ending abortion, all of that, the sanctity of human life, the pro-life industry is not trying to end abortion in the sense of criminalizing it, abolishing it, in the same way, say, you would with slavery or sex trafficking. They say things like, we want abortion to be unthinkable. And to that, I say, well, the only way it's going to be unthinkable is if we have a change of heart, and you can only do that through the gospel and a consistent Christian message. But I don't just want abortion to be unthinkable. I want abortion to be a crime, like slavery, like sex trafficking. I would like sex trafficking to be unthinkable, and I would also like it to be a criminal act. The pro-life industry approaches this from a position of neutrality and from a position that is fundamentally flawed and inconsistent with the gospel message. They say the mother is innocent, that she is a victim like the child, and so they do not want to ever have this ended via criminalization like it used to be in a society that was influenced by the gospel. You can look pre-Roe and even see currently in states across the union that abortion is still seen as murder and homicide and a criminal act in the states. Those laws, many of them never been changed, and they're still on the books. And the pro-life industry also approaches this seeing Roe versus Wade as law. And it was one of the things that was difficult for me to hear sitting in there just now when you had somebody who was opposed to that resolution. They essentially said that. They said, you know, Roe versus Wade made abortion legal in the states. In fact, it did not. It's a court opinion, and the states who had legislation on their books criminalizing abortion, actually, if they agreed with Roe, they had to actually change the laws of those states. They were supposed to change the laws of those states because Roe versus Wade does not create law. Congress creates law in our nation, not the Supreme Court. So we don't understand how our law works in this nation. And one of the ways to highlight that is this particular point. During the last election, President Joe Biden did a town hall, and there was a young woman that came up, and she was concerned with another 4 years of Trump and what that would mean for Roe versus Wade with the people he's adding to the court and all that. And so she was concerned, like, what if Roe versus Wade is overturned? And Joe Biden understands the law in our country better than many pro-life industry leaders. He said that when he becomes president, he wants to give Roe versus Wade the force of law.
Right.
He said that because that's true. In our nation, it says in our constitutional documents that Congress creates law. It's not the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has made many, many fallacious court opinions, and they've been resisted by the states many times. Even during the time of slavery, you have the court case of Dred Scott, and in that case, the states resisted the Supreme Court's very evil opinion, and that needs to be done at the state level in the issue of abortion. So I'll just say finally to this, one of the things that was actually kind of disheartening to hear was one of the vocalizations of opposition against the resolution was, if we pass this resolution, which everybody says, we agree with it, abortion is murder, it's a sin, it's a gospel issue, we need to abolish it. If we pass it, then these pastors are going to have to go back home and have essentially one perspective on this that's consistent with the resolution. This is murder, it needs to be abolished. And essentially say all of our past pro-life moves, you know, we were wrong on those, and this is what we're going to do, and only this. I thought to myself, is it a Christian virtue to say that I was wrong, and that I was to not say that I was wrong, to not say that I was inconsistent, or we did something inconsistently? Like, if we spot an error in our thinking, if we spot an inconsistency, if we see that an industry that we've been paying to fight this is inconsistent and in many respects fundamentally opposed to the gospel itself and to Christian commitment, if we see that that's a problem, aren't we allowed to say we need a course correction? We have to fix this. We've got to approach this consistently as Christians. And so that was disheartening to hear that one of the objections is we're going to have to go back and say that we did this wrong. Well, you know, is it wrong to point out that if Roe versus Wade is overturned tonight at midnight, that tomorrow abortion will still be legal in many states across our union because of the pro-life legislation that's been put into force? In other words, when you put in pro-life incremental legislation that says you cannot kill a baby in this state past 18 weeks or 22 weeks, it actually puts into the force of law that you can kill a baby in this state under 22 weeks or 18 weeks, and that's pro-life legislation. Or we have, let's give an example of two recent victory bills in the state of Arizona that were put forth as pro-life incremental legislation. In Arizona, Kathy Herod opposed my legislation, our legislation for equal protection for all humans, which she says she agrees with. She opposed it because she said mother and baby are both victims themselves. So she doesn't want any penalties. So she said, well, let's vote on this one. So she put forth legislation that was pro-life incremental legislation that says you cannot kill a baby in the state of Arizona for the reason of genetic abnormality. They called that a victory, but it's just an irrelevant bill because all a mother or father has to do in the state of Arizona is say, I'm not killing it because of a genetic abnormality. The Down syndrome doesn't bother me. I just want to kill it. So it's irrelevant. And that's pro-life incremental legislation that they think is praiseworthy, but is in fact irrelevant. All a mother or father has to do is say, I just want to kill the baby. Another one that she put in that is pro-life victory legislation is that you have to give your baby a proper burial after you kill it, which isn't difficult for Planned Parenthood to do. All they have to do is just put into the price of the abortion a proper burial for the baby. It's not as though the mother in Arizona has to go to the funeral or has to handle the body. It's just packed into the price of the abortion. It's not something that's a victory bill. And further, one of the things that was done in Arizona is the pro-life industry decriminalized abortion in the state of Arizona. And this is where I'll stop and I'll let you maybe ask any more questions. What she did was she put forth this pro-life incremental legislation, and inside the bill she also put repeal of 13-3604. What is that? That's the law in Arizona that existed pre-Roe that said that abortion was a crime and that if a mother did it, she'd be criminally penalized. Well, the pro-life industry doesn't want women to be penalized for abortion because she's not guilty. She's a victim as well. So in her incremental legislation, she not only put things in that were irrelevant, that don't do anything to stop abortion, and that still allow for the murder of healthy children in the state of Arizona, she put in a portion of that bill that actually decriminalized abortion for the woman in the state of Arizona. So the pro-life industry decriminalized abortion in the state of Arizona. This is what they considered a victory bill.
Right.
And it's victorious for them in the respect that they don't want to see women ever penalized for abortion.
Right, right. So now you've used the term a number of times. Before we go to what happened today and your description of the gutting of this resolution, a number of times you used the term incremental, sort of assuming everybody knows exactly what you're referring to there. But I think that's where people don't understand. They don't understand where the lines are drawn. Just briefly, what's wrong with incrementally dealing with abortion over against seeking to abolish abortion?
That's a good question. So notwithstanding the doctrinal issues in this debate that the pro-life industry holds to that are fundamentally opposed to a Christian perspective on this, when we talk about incrementalism, what we're talking about is they'll say, well, like Kathy's bill, they'll say you can't kill a baby because it has a genetic abnormality. So that's what they would call an incremental legislation. They think they're incrementally bringing down the number of abortions in the state through incremental moves. I'll give you another example. An incremental move that they think is very victorious, which they opposed 3 years ago, and now they're fully behind in many respects because it's passed in some places. They'll say things like, we have a heartbeat bill. The abortionist has to show or allow the mother to hear the heartbeat of the baby. And they'll say, well, that's an incremental bill that will maybe bring down the number of abortions. The problem with that is what you have to admit to when you move forward with this incremental legislation. Say, take Kathy's, for example. You can't kill a baby for the purpose or because of genetic abnormality. You have to say you can kill a baby if it's healthy. So you're making compromises and concessions where the tragic end of it is not a small issue. It's the end of human life. You have to make compromises and concessions that fundamentally undermine your profession and your commitments. If it's human life from conception and we want all human life protected, then we can't move forward with legislation that ultimately undermines that commitment. And so I'll give you an example of where we would never do this, and it just shows, I think, we've been worked on by our culture. We would never say with sex trafficking, because everyone holds the same perspective on that because of Christianity. Sex trafficking is immoral. Kidnapping and rape is immoral. You can never do this. It's a disgusting, wicked thing. And so we're all unanimous on that. Can you imagine fighting against sex trafficking by saying, you can't sex traffic children over the age of 13? That's an incremental approach to sex trafficking.
Right.
You know, we won't allow any sex trafficking for anybody over the age of 18. Or an incremental approach to sex trafficking would be something like, in a similar way, you can't sex traffic children with Down syndrome. Now, we all recognize the error of that approach in the area of, say, sex trafficking, but we, for some reason, don't recognize it in the area of the protection of human life. And that the great, I think, inconsistency here and tragedy is that pro-life organizations often say at the start of the conversation, we believe in the sanctity of all human life, and we believe that human life begins at conception. Now, that's an indisputable fact of biology. It's consistent, of course, with the Christian worldview. We're all supposed to herald that thing, that truth, that human life begins at conception. The problem is the pro-life industry does not want all human life to have equal protection. And I'll give you an example of this. And this goes to the incremental issue on how this starts to unfold. If you were to ask the leading pro-life industry leaders right now, what do you think should happen to the mother who took her twin girls and drowned them in the bathtub? They were 6 years old. What should happen to that mother? They would all say unanimously, she should have to face justice for that. Right. What should happen to the mother who kills her 5-month-old baby in the womb? And the answer is, well, she's a victim. We don't want her penalized. And it goes to show the fundamental flaw, the fatal flaw, in the pro-life industry and their approach here is they're not consistent, and that inconsistency undermines our fight to end this moral evil.
Okay, so here's the question then. First I see, well, the resolution passed, and then I see statements saying, but it was gutted. So what happened?
So there's a portion of the resolution. So the resolution, if you read it, I encourage everyone to read it, actually is I think it's very well done. It's very consistent. It's something that you could preach on a Sunday in terms of these are consistent biblical truths and its application of those truths. There is a portion of the resolution that really tries to address the error in the incremental approach and the kind of devastating impact it has in actually criminalizing or abolishing abortion or bringing equal protection for all humans. And it talks about the incremental approach. And so what gutted it is there was an appeal to essentially change language in one portion as sort of like a happy middle space. And that's essentially, I don't have the resolution in front of me, but essentially they added the word alone. So we're not going to focus on incrementalism alone, but also abolition. So ultimately it just essentially guts it because it essentially state that incrementalism and how we've been approaching it is still a valid option, but we'd also like to do abolition, and we'd like to, you know, work towards ending this ultimately. There are a number of issues ignored in that approach, and that is all of the erroneous, unbiblical thinking that's underneath the pro-life industry and how they approach this, but it also ignores the challenges presented to us with an incremental approach. The inconsistencies, the wrong approach to how law works in this country, and ultimately the fact, and this is, I think, an important element, I've stated it already, but the incremental approach that these pro-life bills are putting into states will keep abortion legal in the states because it provides definitions. You can have an abortion at this stage, but not after this stage. You can have an abortion if you can't find a heartbeat. And I just want to say, back to the heartbeat issue, when you put a bill in a state that's a pro-life incremental bill that says, if you find a heartbeat, you can't kill it. Question is this, and there's a number of professional people who do ultrasounds that I know very personally that'll tell you it's very easy not to find the heartbeat. And you're trusting abortion facilities who are paid to kill children, this is their business, you're trusting them to find a heartbeat,
yeah,
and to allow the mother to hear the heartbeat. This is their business. This is their industry. They kill babies for a living. And so when you tell Planned Parenthood, find a heartbeat and you can't kill the baby, they don't find heartbeats.
Right.
And also, I wanted to say this final thing. It's another issue that comes up in this. Planned Parenthood loves these incremental legislative moves, like this, like say a heartbeat bill. Why is that? Because it puts the smaller mom and pop abortion facilities out of business because they can't keep up with all the regulations, like wider hallways, use this kind of tool, but not that kind of tool. You got to have an ultrasound machine. It puts the small mom and pop abortionists out of business, and it actually strengthens and increases the size of Planned Parenthood because they have the funds to widen their hallways and to use these instruments, but not these instruments. And so oftentimes these incremental steps actually make Planned Parenthood's business larger.
Wow. Hey, all right. So let me mention, Tom Buck just sent me a tweet. Let me read it to you and get your reaction to this. It was sent to Tom Askell and Tom Buck. If you and Tom Buck do not practice church discipline against all the women and the fathers who had an ectopic pregnancy terminated to save the life of the mother, then you really don't believe the resolution you just supported. You lied. This is from Eric Shoemaker. What would you like to say to Eric Shoemaker?
Yeah, it goes to show that unfortunately a lot of people haven't engaged this issue with the depth of thought and desire to understand that you maybe would do in resolutions concerning CRT. And what I mean by that is that what we're stating here with the resolution to abolish abortion is, here's the definition, human life at conception. Here's the definition. This is sin. here's the definition. God calls this murder. Here's the definition. It's a gospel issue. All those different issues. And what we want is equal protection for all human beings. Now, when someone hears that, they should understand, okay, that's consistent with the biblical worldview. And so what are the implications? And then ask questions about the implications. For example, do you believe with this direction of abolition that it's ever appropriate to attempt to save a mother's physical life if there is something that's broken, something in the rare cases where they can't correct the issue? Can we ever try to preserve life when there's an ectopic pregnancy or something like that? And the answer is, of course we can, but that's a rescue operation.
Right.
That's not an abortion at will. That's not a throwaway of a human life. What we're actually doing in a case like that is usually going to a hospital to save the lives of the baby and the mother. When we have, just take for example this. Oftentimes, you might have an issue in a pregnancy where the baby's life is in danger or the mom's life is in danger. And what typically happens with a right state of mind is mother, father, and baby go to the hospital to work on the preservation of the mother's life and the baby's life.
Right.
And the doctors in those cases are working to preserve both the life of the mother and the life of the baby. And in some cases, rare cases, unfortunately, the fallen world, this happens, we have to make a determination with a car hanging off the cliff and mother and baby are inside and you have a moment to save a life. Do you try to save a life? Absolutely. Does that mean that there's going to be a loss of another life? Yes. But that's a complicated issue that happens in rare cases where you're working towards the preservation of human life. I would say that kind of argument about ectopic pregnancies has strong emotional appeal, but not logical appeal. And it's not even something that argues against this resolution. This resolution is providing definitions and it's providing goals. And it does not ignore the fact that in a fallen world, sometimes you have to work towards the preservation of human life to the degree that you can only save one life. I think it's a silly argument, ultimately.
Yeah. Well, and at Apologia Church, we know about ectopic pregnancies. We've got a lot of experience.
You know, it's interesting, James. My wife and I, we've lost two pregnancies. One was with twins, and it's interesting because my wife had to get a D and what is it, a D and E? Is that what you call it?
Yes.
It's similar to the procedure that they do in abortion at will to kill babies in the womb. And what's interesting is in the case of my wife, when we lost our twins, she had to go to the hospital. She had to go to the hospital to have a procedure to save her life because both babies had died in the womb. They were overwhelmed, essentially. It was essentially like cancer that overwhelmed both babies. And she had to go to the hospital to preserve her life. She had to have the babies removed from her body. But she went to a hospital for that. And that was the goal, was the preservation of life. And, of course, the first thing was to say, is there any way to save these babies' lives? And so it's interesting. You know, in a case like this, when someone has to argue against a position like this, by bringing it down to the most rare cases, in a situation we can do nothing about, and using that to argue against this entire resolution, which provides biblical definitions, gospel-centered goals, I think it shows the weakness of their position, and they haven't really thought through this issue or engaged with people on this side.
Right.
So it's unfortunately, but it means we have a lot of work to do.
So real quickly, what does Bill Askell say? What's the next step?
I'm still here, and I was actually going to try to connect with Bill here before we leave. There's a lot of people here, thousands and thousands of people here. So I'm going to try to touch base with Bill in just a few minutes here and check in with him.
Okay. Well, also, Tom Buck is looking for you.
I was just watching the tail end of that when you were on with Tom, and I'm not ignoring him, and I've been trying to meet him too. As a matter of fact, I was literally 2 inches from him earlier, but he was too busy to talk to me, so it's his fault, not mine.
Well, I've done my part. I've told you he's safe. I've told him, you're safe. Yeah. It's good. So hopefully we can get you all together.
I will tell you this, brother, to encourage you. So I've been here since Monday, and I'm exhausted. I'm really, really tired. But God's done some amazing things here. We've got some new connections to get some bills of equal protection in the different states, Louisiana and Florida. Some great things have been happening as a result of being here. But I'll tell you that since Monday till now, I can't tell you how many hundreds, and I mean that literally, maybe more, hundreds of people that I've run into, just lines of people that have been expressing their gratitude for the ministry of Apologia Church, Apologia Studios, the teaching ministry that's changed their lives, transformed them. And, of course, many people are always mentioning, I was watching Pastor James, and now I learned about you, and I've learned about youth, and went to Pastor James. So tremendously blessed. I mean, I just can't tell you how many people have just given an overwhelming blessing to how much God is using these ministries. So praise God.
Yeah, excellent. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time. I know you are, you must be tired, and but we wanted to know what had happened with that particular resolution and what it meant. And so I appreciate you doing that and bringing us up to speed. And so are you preaching Sunday?
Supposed to be.
Uh-huh. Okay. I think I might need to be thinking about something, because this would
maybe
this
have something in the chamber.
This would not be the first time that Jeff goes someplace, figures he's going to be oh so cool and go ahead and preach, and then not so much on Saturday night. I get the phone call.
I have it ready. I have a 3.5 hour flight tomorrow home, so I was thinking of just finishing up the last parts tomorrow.
Uh-huh.
But if I happen to pass out on the plane, I'll give you a call and let you know that I wasn't able to.
Yeah, so I just want to point out that we actually dismissed service at 5:55 p.m.
What happened?
Did Sunday.
Something go wrong?
Nope.
Did something go wrong?
Nope. We got everything done, and we were out of there at 5:55 p.m. Just
I personally would feel gypped if I
Okay. All right. Fine. All right. Well, thanks, Jeff, for joining us today and keeping us up on speed. And we'll, Lord willing, we'll see you Sunday one way or the other.
All right, brother. Thank you.
All right. God bless. Bye-bye. I better have something ready for Sunday. That's all I can say. Jeff always schedules more than Jeff can do. It's better than being lazy. I can guarantee you that. But yeah, I'm thinking what.
So I want to jump in here real quick on his comment regarding the ectopic pregnancies.
Yeah,
because you know he kind of went a long way around it, but ultimately it's a red herring. The entire example. That's
because the baby can't survive one way or the other,
right? And that's the problem in all these examples that this entire movement, no matter how subtle they try to be, they keep bringing up the life of the mother. You know what? You're just using that as a way in which the doctor can write down on a piece of paper her life was in danger. Why was her life in danger?
Yeah.
I don't have to actually list that. I just have to say it.
Right.
It doesn't have to be true. And it's all a red herring in order to work around it. And the fact that Arizona repealed a law that was clear in the process of doing good and trying to correct, step at a time, baby steps, really?
That was really amazing to me when I found out that they had done that. And that it was the pro-life people that did it. That was what was just so
astonishing. There's very little bit of honesty going on here in it. And that example, shame on that person. Shame on them.
Yeah. And by the way, it would be Eric Schumacher. I said maker, but then I looked at it and it's clearly a German spelling. So sorry about that, Eric, but you were wrong anyways. Anyway, all right, so there you go. We went a little bit over time, but I really appreciate Tom Buck and Jeff Durbin for just jumping on real quick. We didn't want to go too long today, especially because I know Rich is going to have to do some repair on the file. And so the longer we go, the more complicated that becomes. So apologies for that. So I don't know what the rest of the schedule is going to be like. Tomorrow's hopefully, Lord willing, going to be taken up with something else, something exciting, something challenging, something that makes me nervous. But as things develop, hey, I've been throwing little dividing lines out there in the middle of things, so who knows what will happen later in the week.